Reading this evening is taken from Matthew chapter 5, starting at verse 27, and can be found on page 969 of the Church Bibles. Matthew chapter 5, starting at verse 27, adultery. You have heard that it was said, "Do not commit adultery." But I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, gouge it out and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. This is the word of the Lord.
Well, last week, I believe you looked at the subject that none of us can avoid, but have not yet experienced, death. Today, we're looking at a subject that none of us have not experienced, sexual temptation. So it doesn't matter whether you're 14, 19 or 90, whether you're male or female, married or single, widowed or divorced, you all know exactly what we're talking about. It's been part of your experience, and I venture to suggest that it will continue to be so. A few years ago, the Deputy Prime Minister accidentally coined a new phrase in the English language, the Cleggover. What happened was that the leader of the then Liberal Democrat Party was asked in an interview by Piers Morgan for a GQ magazine, "How many women have you slept with?" Well, unlike other politicians who would probably just say, you know, "I'm not going there," and dodge it, Nick Clegg replied, "No more than 30. This was followed up with, "Would you ever be unfaithful to your wife, who he married when he was 24? His reply, "I certainly hope not." Listen to what Carol Midgley, writing in The Times that week, said. "No, no, no, Nick. It's like this, see. One hopes that one won't get flattened by a bus on the way to work in the morning. One hopes that a random pigeon won't crap on one's head. One hopes that one's private parts won't be ravaged by necrotizing fasciitis," whatever that is. "These are things that we are powerless to control. Being faithful to your wife, on the other hand, is not. All you have to do when faced with another woman offering on a plate is to say, 'No thanks.' Voila, no uncertainty whatsoever. What all wives would want to hear in such an instance would be nice, clear, robust denial. 'Of course I'll never be unfaithful to my wife. Haven't you seen how gorgeous she is?' would have been a good response. Even a cheesy plagiarism of Paul Newman's line, 'Why go out for a burger when you can have steak at home?' would have done," she suggests. Well, the advantage of picking books of the Bible to go through, or even parts of books of the Bible, is that you have to cover subjects you might choose not to do so, because they may well be difficult or embarrassing. So before we look at adultery, we ought to look at marriage. Family life is God's norm for society. It's the ideal arrangement for human beings to be born into, to be nurtured into, and to be supported through life. If you ever go to a wedding, listen carefully to the preface it spells out. If you go to one where they use the old prayer book, it's very kind of blunt language, but in the more modern ones, it's all a little bit kind of, well, softer and less clear, but it basically boils down to companionship, sex, and children in that order. Companionship, a mate, a best friend to share one's life with. A husband and wife may comfort and help each other, living faithfully together in need and in plenty, in sorrow and in joy. Children, that they may be blessed in caring for them and bringing them up in accordance with God's will to his praise and glory, and the joy of their physical union, that with delight and tenderness they may know each other in love, and through the joy of their bodily union may strengthen the union of their hearts and lives. It's all very nicely put. The prayer book talks about carnal lusts and stuff like that, which is, you know, older language, but a lot clearer. So sexual intercourse is the epicenter of this marriage relationship. It's obviously a physical and a biological union, but that's simply the mechanism, the outward expression. What makes it is the emotional, psychological, spiritual, social union that it gives expression to. The depth of that intimacy is based on trust. A couple trust each other more and more, then they'll be able to have their trust expressed in unconditional love, and their degree of togetherness, their sense of intimacy, will deepen. Anything which breaks that trust is disastrous. It slams the marriage relationship into sharp reverse. Now, I don't know how familiar you are with women's magazines. My knowledge is microscopic, but I do remember giving some reflection to them, and they seem to divide into sort of two categories. There are the sort of classier ones, like, Cosmopolitan, Options, She, whatever, and there are the kind of, a bit more down-market ones, really, such as... I don't think I probably recorded it here, but anyway. It seems to me that the big glossy ones, like the ones I've mentioned, seem to always write about adultery as if it's something rather exciting and spices up one's life. So, for example, I do remember reading in She magazine once about two people, one was 40, the other was 39, and the guy writing it doesn't define what he gets up to as adultery. He thinks of it more as kind of philandering. You know, he has to have, he says, other women friends. And his wife, you know, one of the kinds that presumably reads that sort of magazine, that she seems to go along with it. And even the 9-year-old daughter does. They like to meet these other women, although the 9-year-old does provide him with a list of who he's not to, who are out of bounds. They do, of course, include her school teacher. Can you believe it? Well, it was in there, so there we go. That's the view of the glosses for the more sophisticated, by a guy who is a kind of probably bohemian, cosmopolitan, London-lovey writer sort. But when you move down market to the cheaper stuff, what is the reality? What's it really like? You know, read the problem pages. I've been to bed with my best friend's husband and now I'm pregnant. I got drunk at the office party and had a one-night stand, but I've now got this soreness. I dread going to the doctor in case I've got an STI, and they'll tell my wife in case I've given it to her. Well, Carol Midgley again, writing in the Times, and I apologise for the kind of brutalness of the way in which she writes. She says, "Most men, I think, genuinely want to be faithful, but faced with temptation, couldn't put their hand on their heart and say that they would definitely resist it." She says, "Look, it's not their fault, it's testosterone." She goes on, "A swift vox pop of 10 of my male friends in long-term relationships reveals that 90% of them, 9 out of the 10, would enthusiastically get their cleg over if they could be guaranteed to get away with it. But would I mind not telling their partners that that was the answer they gave? Actually," she says, "it may chasten them to know that most of the women were not exactly averse to the idea either. Only one man who has been through 2 messy divorces caused by his infidelity said, 'I would sooner put my blank in a vice than go through all that again.'" It's worth sharing such stark language because it is disastrous, and you'll remember it because of the stark language. What real life experience tells you is that it is a complete an utter mess. As the actress Holly Bird once observed from one of her plays, it's a mug's game. The married man invariably goes back to the wife and the kids. So adultery is damaging. It damages children. Rob Parsons of Care for the Family, in his book Loving Against the Odds, quotes a comment from a little 8-year-old boy who put it all in context when he said, "My dad doesn't love my mum anymore, and he's found someone else. But he doesn't know how sad we are, because I know that if he did, he would never have left us." Abandoned children are not only emotionally poorer, they're also materially poorer. In fact, measured against every indices you can think of, they are at a disadvantage. Lord Halsey was a professor of social administrative studies at Oxford. He's a Labour peer. No one, he says, from his research can deny that divorce, separation, birth outside marriage and one-parent families, as well as cohabitation and extramarital sexual intercourse, have increased rapidly. Many applaud these freedoms. But what should be universally acknowledged is that the children of parents who do not follow the traditional norm are thereby disadvantaged in many major aspects of their chances of living a successful life. On the evidence available, such children tend to die earlier, to have more illness, to do less well at school, to exist at a lower level of nutrition, comfort, and conviviality, to suffer more unemployment, to be more prone to deviance and crime, and finally to repeat the cycle of unstable parenting from which they themselves have suffered. Of course, Halsey is just referring to averages. He is not saying that all traditionally reared children do well and all children from parentally deprived homes do badly. But on average, what he says is sadly true. Many children feel appallingly down, and they are right to think that way. The son deprived of a role model, the daughter with no dad around, may end up hating and mistrusting men and perhaps develop an unhealthy relationship with someone of their own sex, or they may go the other way completely. And in their desire for a male security figure, throw themselves at any available older man and pay a high price for doing so. I met an old friend this week, and we reminisced on life at university. We talked about some of our contemporaries. We reminded ourselves of one contemporary whose funeral we went to 20 years ago. Someone who had in her time worked for a variety of evangelical organisations, UCCF, Operation Mobilisation, Evangelical Alliance and Lion Publishing. But in her late 30s, with the biological clock ticking faster, it seems she wanted a child, and so she found a bloke and she got pregnant. The bloke wasn't interested, he wasn't a Christian. He was an atheistic Jew, if I remember rightly, and they never married. She did find another chap to live with, but she died of cancer at the age of 41 with a 2-year-old orphan, with no knowledge of its father. I commend her for having the baby and not aborting it, but I rate her actions as incredibly selfish and pretty wicked, and I hope she was able to come to her senses and to make her peace with God before she died. And then there are those who, when in a fix, do even worse, the unwanted pregnancy, which they terminate. It may seem an easy way out, but not when you see a film of the first 12 weeks of life in the womb, and you realize it's got a brain, it's got a heart, it can feel. The baby may go, but the guilt won't so easily disappear. And then there's the damage to a husband or wife, the betrayal, the letdown. After all, they have a right to you honouring your vows for better or for worse, for richer or poorer, in need and in plenty, in sickness and in health, to death us do part. They promise to forsake all others for as long as we both shall live. And even if, as the actress observed, he does invariably go back to the wife, and the wife invariably goes back to the kids and the husband, there is blocked intimacy. They may be forgiven, but trust and love don't return overnight. It takes time. Or what if it was a one-night stand, a fling at the sales conference? What then? Do you tell or don't you? Would she accept and forgive, or pack your bags and kick you out? The sexual ghost is there to haunt you. And then there's the damage to yourself. Affairs produce promise much and deliver little. I can remember one man, a chief executive in the NHS, had a lovely wife, a home, a family, and great prospects, who had a fling, a perk of his plateaued career. A few months is all it lasted, but his wife didn't have him back, and he lived a pathetic little life in a rented flat. Or I think of a man who left his wife and two sons for another woman, and his wife then committed suicide. His new wife wouldn't have his two sons, so they were brought up by the grandparents. That's a lot to have on your conscience for your actions. We elevate and even celebrate people in magazines like Hello and in the TV chat shows. We celebrate people like Hugh Grant. We celebrate politicians like Nick Clegg and Boris Johnson and Ken Livingstone, who are all on public record about their adultery. Two of them have a number of children outside of wedlock. And yet, they make a mess of their lives and the lives of other people. And yet, we celebrate them. Our morality is highly subjective. And we are fools. God's ways are the best ways. And a lifelong monogamous marriage is the way to bring up kids who have the right to that. And to have provided for them as they enter into this world such an upbringing that gives them the very best chances in life. Not surprisingly, the Old Testament is very hard on adulterers. The penalty was death. It was a recognition of how much damage adultery could do. In Saudi Arabia today, adultery is punished by the chopping off of your head. Stealing is punished by the chopping off of your hands. And while not for a moment endorsing such penalties today, what they do at least say is that crimes against people are greater than crimes against property. We tend to reverse that. We think property is more important than people. So what then is the New Testament penalty for adultery? Well, there is none. None in this life. It is forbidden, but we don't live in a theocracy where God rules. There is no sanction to be applied against anybody who commits it. But that doesn't mean to say that there is no penalty. The penalty is merely delayed. The penalty, Jesus says, is this, and he says it twice. You are in danger of hell and a fate worse than death. So let's realize two things from these few verses. How easily any of us could commit adultery, and how then we can avoid doing so. So how easy it is for any of us to commit adultery. First of all, Jesus shrewdly points out that adultery begins in the brain, not in the bed. The Pharisees were concerned with externals of the law. Jesus goes to the heart of the matter. It's what's inside us that matters. Jesus intensifies and sharpens the seventh commandment. He says, "You've heard that it was said, 'Do not commit adultery,' but I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in her heart." It is not that Jesus is trying to ruin our fun. Rather, Jesus is warning us of the slippery slope. Edmund Burke, the 18th century political statesman and political thinker, said, "The instances are exceedingly rare of men immediately passing over a clear marked line from virtue into declared vice and corruption. There are middle tints and shades between the two extremes. There is something uncertain on the confines of the two empires which they must pass through and which renders the change easy and imperceptible." Some of the messes that people get into that we've mentioned, which you can read about, which you know from your observation of life, where you work or where you study, it all starts in the brain, in the mind. People contemplate adultery. What would it be like? How could it happen? And then somehow down the track it does. What is contemplated gets committed. I'm sure you're aware of the various danger points in life. Well, there's always, when you're teenagers, there's Christmas parties and summer holidays, or if you're a young student. But once you've got married and children come along, there can be times of difficulty. When somebody says, when the wife is incredibly tired with a young baby, well, children are the best form of contraception. The wife's exhausted, completely devoted to the kids. The husband's out still trying to progress up his particular career. He feels he works longer. He feels neglected. He talks to a female colleague at work. She listens. They spend time together. And the next sales conference they're away on, well, the inevitable happens. So easy, yet so awful. What a time to betray one's wife. Then there's the seven-year itch, as they say. This time, it's her. He's taken her for granted. He's still climbing the company tree. She's beginning to get out and about. Perhaps she has a part-time job. Perhaps she joins the Parent Teachers Association, becomes a school governor or something. And another committee member is one who always listens to her, values her point of view. They have a drink after the meeting. And he's not just listening to her educational matters, but intimate ones about her children, about her husband, about the state of her marriage. And she likes talking to him. She begins to take more of an interest in her appearance. Life seems to have a bit more spark in it. She is heading for trouble. Or the midlife crisis. He has plateaued in his career. His wife has reinstated or relaunched her, and she's doing quite nicely. Bit too busy with work, bit too kind of stressed with the kids and any extra study, and he's got time on his hands, and he thinks to himself, he thinks, "Is this all I've achieved? Is it downhill all the way from now?" And he can turn into an LCT, the most pathetic species, the last chance trendy. You can probably imagine them. You know, they exist. You know, I've seen them. I don't think I've ever become one, but I have definitely seen them in some of my friends. And it is truly pathetic. Or another danger zone is when children leave home. And then you're left talking to each other. And have you got anything left to talk about? You know, the wife is on HRT, hormone replacement therapy, if that's still healthy or not. And it's the last chance in her life. And people do the most ridiculous things. Well, there are many other scenarios and danger zones which you'll probably have observed and been familiar with. The tragedy is that they do happen. So finally, how do we avoid them, 29 and 30? The first thing is to recognise that it could happen to any of us, with drastic consequences for us, for our family, for other people, and the very real prospect of hell forever. So drastic action is needed. That's why Jesus uses such extravagant language. It's hyperbole. It is exaggeration. So we need, first of all, to control our eyes. Bishop Taylor Smith was a former chaplain general during the First World War for the British Army. He was a real man's man and a great evangelist. And he enjoyed looking at pretty women. However, he always turned his enjoyment to prayer. He thanked God for making her beautiful and prayed she would be given extra strength for the extra temptation. With eyes, you can appreciate beauty, but with eyes, you can do all sorts of things, but you mustn't dwell for too long on appearances or they can turn to lust. So eyes need to be controlled. Hands also need to be controlled. In different cultures, different people vary as to how tactile they are. We all need to know when we are touching inappropriately. In our British culture, the amount of physical touch is, of course, a reflection of the closeness of a relationship. So it starts at a nod. You might just acknowledge somebody. You may shake their hands. You may give a vigorous handshake. You might do a polite embrace at arm's length. You may give a hearty sort of hug. Or it may be a passionate clench. But there's an appropriate physical expression for the state of your relationship. So we need to be self-disciplined enough to know what's appropriate. And I think we probably all know when we're crossing the boundary. We also need to control our feet, because there are some parts of some cities that we shouldn't go to. There are some shelves in some bookshops that we should not look at. Some people need to run a mile, if that is an area that particularly tempts them, especially with the internet nowadays. I remember the case of one chap I was at theological college with. In his curacy, so we're talking 30 years ago, it's no one who's ever been here and no one you know. But he went to visit someone who had one of those speaker phones on the door, and they could operate it remotely. So he pressed it. "Come in," she said. So he did. "I'm up here." It was one of those houses where the lounge is on the first floor, so he goes up to the first floor. "Come up." That was on the next flight of stairs he went up, and he went in. "I'm here." And as he looked into the bedroom, there she was, stark naked on the bed. He shot out of the house as fast as he could. Now, it's very funny, but it's true. It's real carry-on stuff, isn't it? But it could have ended in tragedy if he hadn't run. For some of you today, you'll have realised that you've crossed the line somewhere in life, and or you're in serious danger of doing so. It may only be in your mind at present, or it may sadly be being expressed. For you, though, there's only really one course of action, and that's about to do an about turn and to run away from it. For others of you, this may have evoked painful memories. Too many Christians are paralyzed because of past sin. But what can God not do? Well, God can't sin. God can't coexist with sin. And God can't remember forgiven sin. So forgive yourself, serve God, and know him intimately again, and stay close to him. Avail yourselves of the means of grace, the Bible, prayer, Christian fellowship, and obedience. And there are lessons for all of us to learn if we're to avoid falling into any sin ourselves. So if you're married, invest time with your partner. Why not kind of choose a night of the week which is just exclusively yours? Get a takeaway meal and enjoy 2 hours of each other's company. Be careful about the listening ear. You should really only share things with your partner, not with somebody else. If you share them with somebody else, you should have your partner's permission and awareness. We should live an active Christian life, unlike King David, who was idle and fell into sin. We shouldn't be sloppy. We shouldn't opt out. We should be like Joseph had to be when he had to run away from a situation of temptation. We should remember the moral benefits of wisdom. And on reading Proverbs 2, I end. My son, if you accept my words and store up my commands within you, turning your ear to wisdom and applying your heart to understanding, and if you call out for insight and cry aloud for understanding, and if you look for it as for silver and search for it as for hidden treasure, then you will understand the fear of the Lord and find the knowledge of God. For the Lord gives wisdom. It will save you. Verse 16 of Proverbs 2, it will save you also from the adulteress, from the wayward wife with her seductive words, who has left the partner of her youth and ignored the covenant she made before God. For her house leads down to death, and her paths to the spirits of the dead. None who go to her return or attains the path of life. Let's pray. If this particular area of life is a particular temptation to you, or whether there's another area of life which is equally kind of strong in its kind of draw or attraction for you, remember this verse from 1 Corinthians 10:13. No temptation has seized you except what is common to man, or no different from what others have experienced. And God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. But when you are tempted, he will also provide a way out so that you can stand up under it. Almighty and everlasting God, you hate nothing that you have made and forgive the sins of all who are penitent, making us new and contrite hearts so that, lamenting our sins and acknowledging our wretchedness, we may receive from you, the God of all mercy, perfect remission and forgiveness through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.